Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I've just returned from a great midsummer trip to New York. I spent hours in my favorite museums. All right, of course, I might have visited a store or two. Could you walk up Madison or down Lex and not?
Really?
But I digress. After a day of enjoying some of the world's greatest art, I happily whiled away the hours in the city's plentiful bookstores, researching this week's show. The result? A multi-hued composition of art history, artists, and art-centric novels. You'll get the picture as we turn to page one of the book report.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
The Efrusis were a grand banking family in 19th century Paris and Vienna, as rich and respected as the Rothschilds. Yet, by the end of World War II, almost the only thing remaining of their vast empire was a collection of 264 wood and ivory carvings, none of them larger than a matchbox. In The Hair with Amber Eyes, A Family Century of Art and Loss, the renowned ceramic artist Edmond Duval became the fifth generation to inherit this small and exquisite collection of Netsuke. Entranced by their beauty and mystery, he determined to trace the story of his family through the story of the collection. The Netsuke were gathered by Charles Efrusi at the height of the Parisian rage for all things Japanese. Charles had shunned the place set aside for him in the family business to make a study of art and of beautiful living. An early supporter of the Impressionists, he appears in Renoir's Luncheon of the Boating Party. Marcel Proust studied Charles closely enough to use him as a model for Swan in Remembrance of Things Past. The war changed the family's world beyond recognition. Efrusi and his cosmopolitan family were imprisoned or scattered, and the Nazis appropriated their magnificent palace on the Ringstrasse. A library of priceless books and a collection of old master paintings were confiscated. But the Netsuke were smuggled away by their loyal maid Anna and hidden in her straw mattress. Years after the war, she would find a way to return them to a family she'd served, even in their exile. This, then, is the remarkable story of a family, their art, and of a tumultuous century. Michael Maloney narrates.
Two afternoons a week, I was in the archive room of the Nihon Mingei Japan, the Japanese Folk Crafts Museum, working on a book about leech. The museum is a reconstructed farmhouse in a suburb which houses the collection of Japanese and Korean folk crafts of Yanagi Soetsu. Yanagi, a philosopher, art historian, and poet, had evolved a theory of why some objects, pots, baskets, cloth made by unknown craftsmen, were so beautiful. In his view, they expressed unconscious beauty because they had been made in such numbers that the craftsman had been liberated from his ego. He and Leech had been inseparable friends as young men in the early part of the 20th century in Tokyo, writing animated letters to each other about their passionate reading of Blake and Whitman and Ruskin. They had even started an artist's colony in a hamlet, a convenient distance outside Tokyo, where Leech made his pots with the help of local boys and Yanagi discoursed on Rodin and beauty to his bohemian friends. Through a door, the stone floors would give way to office linoleum, and down off a back corridor was Yanagi's archive, a small room, 12 feet by 8, with shelves to the ceiling full of his books and stacked with manila boxes containing his notebooks and correspondence. There was a desk and a single bulb. I like archives. This one was very, very quiet, and it was extremely gloomy. Here I read and noted and planned a revisionist history of Leech. It was to be a covert book on Japonisme, the way in which the West had passionately and creatively misunderstood Japan for more than 100 years. I wanted to know what it was about Japan that produced such intensity and zeal in artists, and such crossness in academics, as they pointed out one misinterpretation after another. I hoped that writing this book would help me out of my own deep, congested infatuation with the country. And one afternoon a week, I spent with my great-uncle, Iggy. I'd walk up the hill from the subway station, past the glowing beer-dispensing machines, past Senkakuji Temple, where the 47 samurai are buried, past the strange baroque meeting hall for a Shinto sect, past the sushi bar run by the bluff Mr. X, turning right at the high wall of Prince Takamatsu's garden with the pines. I'd let myself in and take the lift up to the 6th floor. Iggy would be reading in his armchair by the window, mostly Elmore Leonard or John le Carré, or memoirs in French. "It is odd," he said, "how some languages are warmer than others." I would bend down and he'd give me a kiss. His desk held an empty blotter, a sheaf of his headed paper, and pens ready, though he no longer wrote. The view from the window behind him was of cranes. Tokyo Bay was disappearing behind 40-story condominiums. We'd have lunch together, prepared by his housekeeper, Mrs. Nakano, or left by his friend Jiro, who lived in the interconnecting apartment. An omelette and salad, and toasted bread from one of the excellent French bakeries in the department stores in the Ginza. A glass of cold white wine, Sancerre or Puy Fumé, a peach, some cheese, and then very good coffee. Black coffee. Iggy was 84 and slightly stooped. He was always impeccably dressed, handsome in his herringbone jackets with a handkerchief in the pocket, his pale shirts, and a cravat. He had a small white moustache. After our lunch, he'd open the sliding doors of the long vitrine that took up most of one wall of the sitting room, and we'd get out the netsuke one by one. The hare with amber eyes. The young boy with the samurai sword and helmet. A tiger, all shoulder and feet, turning round to snarl. He would pass me one, and we'd look at it together, and then I'd put it carefully back amongst the dozens of animals and figures on the glass shelves. I'd fill the little cups of water kept in the case to make sure the ivories didn't split in the dry air.
We've just heard The Hare with Amber Eyes by Edmond Duval. In the mid-19th century, a young Claude Monet decided he would rather endure a difficult life painting landscapes than take over his father's nautical supply business. In Claude and Camille, a novel of Monet, Stephanie Cowell explores the obstacles confronting the artist, an art world that refused to validate his style, his extreme poverty, and a war that led him away from his home and friends. But there were bright spots, deep, enduring friendships with Renoir, Cézanne, Pizarro, and Manet, a group that would come to be known as the Impressionists and that supported each other through the difficult years. But even more illuminating was his lifelong love, Camille Danceau, a beautiful upper-class Parisian girl who threw away her privileged life to be by the side of the defiant painter and embrace the lively bohemian life of their time. His muse, his best friend, his passionate lover, and the mother to his 2 children, Camille stayed with Monet and believed in his work, even as they suffered the indignities of destitution. She comforted him during his frequent emotional torrents, but Camille had her own demons, secrets that Monet could never penetrate, including one that, when eventually revealed, would pain him so deeply he'd never fully recover. Christopher Casanova narrates this vividly rendered portrait of both the rise of Impressionism and of the artist at its center.
I have so much fire in me and so many plans. I always want the impossible.
Take clear water with grass waving at the bottom. It's wonderful to look at, but to try to paint it is enough to make one insane. Claude Monet. In the town of Le Havre, the harbour water changed colour every hour. Sometimes it was bright blue-green, sometimes exhausted grey, and other times a mysterious inky black. Boats creaked against their anchors, from great English ships with towering masts to little shabby fishing boats, wind-worn and piled with soggy nets. The wind always carried the smell of salt and fresh, slippery fish, which spilled out daily on the wet, rough wharf-boards. The ropes were every shade of brown. 17-year-old Claude Monet strolled down the main street in his dark suit and starched lace cuffs, his thick dark hair tucked beneath his jaunty hat and an artist's portfolio under his arm. Pushing open the creaking door of the art supply shop, he called out, "Bonjour, monsieur." Old Gravier limped from the shadows, illuminated by a few oil lamps.
"There you are," he exclaimed. "Did you bring more of your work to sell?"
Claude dropped the portfolio on the counter and lifted his new caricatures, drawn with huge heads and minuscule twigs of bodies in the popular Parisian style. The old man chuckled, showing his broken, tobacco-stained front teeth.
"You clever boy," he lisped. "Yes, people will pay well for these. Commissions come in every day for you. Can you go to this address first thing in the morning? The gentleman who lives there is eager to have his caricature made. He's the father of your friend Mark from your Lithe, which hasn't yet let out for today, I believe."
"Hasn't it?" Claude replied airily, taking the address and ignoring the subtle inquiry. He turned away to glance out the window and down the street to where ships bobbed in the water, their masts moving back and forth. Someone was coming past the shop and in through the door. Who is it, he thought, a little uneasily.
Ah, no one much. Only Eugène Boudin, one of several local painters who haunted the area with an easel weighing down his shoulder, always wearing the same clothes and shapeless brown hat. He was, perhaps, 40. Friends said you could set a firecracker off near him when he was painting and he'd never hear it.
As Boudin walked across the floor, nodding pleasantly to them, the closing door created a sudden small wind, which lifted a few sheets of drawing paper from Claude's portfolio. The young man dropped hastily to his knees to retrieve them.
"Bonjour, Monet," Boudin said. "Allow me to help."
He also stooped to retrieve a paper that had blown against the counter and glanced at it. Stroking his beard, he studied a chalk sketch of boats.
"But what have we here?" he asked, surprised. "Is this yours?"
"It's mine. Merci,"
Claude replied stiffly, holding out his hand.
"But it's very good indeed. I didn't know you drew seriously."
"Oh, I don't draw seriously," Claude replied as he put his drawing away. "I just do it for my amusement between my real work."
"Your real work?"
"Yes, I intend to be the most famous caricaturist in France."
Boudin began to sift through a large wood box of oil paint tubes that Gravier had brought him. He weighed a few in his hand, his face thoughtful. Looking up at Claude again, he said,
"So that satisfies you, eh? But come, you've never tried oils or landscapes?"
That was Claude and Camille by Stephanie Cowell. Pilgrim is an award-winning CNN correspondent and news anchor who has turned her talents to writing fiction. Kitty anchored the CNN Early Edition in the late 90s and then anchored primetime broadcasts from 2001 to 2010. Kitty is the recipient of many awards, including the Overseas Press Club Award, a Peabody, and the New York Society of Black Journalists Award. Welcome, Kitty. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Well, The Stolen Chalice is a page-turner that blends ancient art treasures with bioterrorism. How did you come up with this story?
Well, as a reporter for 24 years, you actually have always the worst-case scenario in mind. What possibly could happen? What could go wrong? In fact, my children have always accused me of being just like always focused on what could go wrong. So, you know, bioterrorism, some of the great world threats are, you know, always in my consciousness. But I'm a great art lover, too. So it was a natural combination.
From reading the book, I could tell that you are an avid student of art history. How long have you studied?
Well, you know, I never studied it formally, but I'm a, you know, just addicted museum goer. And so in New York, I live just a few blocks from the Metropolitan Museum, and I have for maybe 30 years. So whenever I have 10 minutes, I just run over and look at something beautiful. And, you know, over the years, I've just become more and more enamored of different collections. Sometimes it's the Chinese collection. Just recently, I just started to really fall in love with the whole Egyptian collection, and that's what inspired the Stolen Chalice. It's an Egyptian theme. And then, of course, the Brooklyn Museum has one of the best collections of mummies, so I contacted them, and it went from there.
All right. You introduced your characters, John Sinclair and Cordelia Stapleton, in the Explorers Club, and they feature again in the Stolen Chalice. Are they based on actual people?
They are and they aren't. The Explorer's Code was an attempt to take a thriller with a real thriller hero like John Sinclair and to match him with an equally strong woman. And so Cordelia Stapleton is a figment of my imagination, but when I tried to figure out what she would do as an occupation, I picked oceanographer. So I actually wrote the entire thing with Cordelia and then contacted Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And they said to me, you know, it's really funny because the head of the ALVIN program is a woman. And I met Susan Humphreys up at Woods Hole. And then after that, Susan Humphreys and I talked about what her character might be like. And I sort of tweaked her character based on conversations with a real oceanographer who does work on the ALVIN program.
All right. You're a member of the Historic Explorers Club. Tell us a little about that.
The Explorers Club was founded by some of the, you know, old polar explorers who were trying to find the North Pole, and, you know, they went to Antarctica. And it's an American organization. It's their headquarters is on the Upper East Side in Manhattan in this very beautiful old townhouse stuffed with polar bears and sledges that have gone to the Arctic. And it's just a really beautiful old clubhouse. And the members have always been people who are explorers. And so you have to be invited to be a member. You have to have done something very sort of explorational, if that's the word. And really, now these days, it's scientists, really. It's botanists and oceanographers and astronauts. And so you always have a fantastic conversation when you go there because there's so many interesting people. And they're all interested in exploration.
So have you explored some very exotic place?
I have. I've been to some very, very exotic places. I think one of the most exotic places I put into the Explorer's Code, and that is Arctic Svalbard, which is very high Arctic, just before the polar cap. It's the last bit of land before you hit the polar ice cap up near the North Pole. And it's part of Norway. It's an island that belongs to Norway. And so I actually put that in the Explorer's Code so that my readers could actually go to an exotic destination without having to put on 50 pounds of polar gear.
Well, the Stolen Chalice has many exotic locales. Had you traveled to every location before writing about it?
This is what I do. I mean, I just continue my job as a reporter by going to each place. And then I feel I write so well when I try to evoke the feeling of that place. So, and I also shoot videos. So, for example, in Egypt, I, you know, went to Egypt and shot video of some of the places that I wanted to show. And just, it gives me a better feeling of the whole, you know, the whole, it's an easier way to write for me because that's how I've always written. I've always shot video and then wrote to the pictures. So if I continue to do that, then I can be a novelist.
What's your next project?
I've actually started to do some traveling for the next book. So I've got a whole wish list of places I want to go and start to noodle the next in the Sinclair Cordelia series.
Kitty, what sets your book apart from others in the genre?
You know, the whole intent of this series is fact-based fiction. So everything in the book is grounded in fact. So, for example, in The Explorer's Code, the 1918 pandemic as a subplot, and I researched that very heavily, and I actually vetted all the information through the Harvard School of Public Health, who looked at all of my virology research. And so I have very strongly feel that when you read one of my books, you are going to read things that are accurate, that they're not, it's of course it's a fictitious plot, but your knowledge base will expand because I really want everyone to gain more real knowledge, and that's the reporter in me that insists on doing that.
Well, you've done a wonderful job. I enjoyed reading The Stolen Talus, and I encourage folks to pick it up. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Provenance, How a Con Man and a Forger Rewrote the History of Modern Art, is a fast-paced investigation of one of the 20th century's most audacious art frauds. Investigative reporters Lainey Salisbury and Ali Sujo recount the tale of a great con man and an unforgettable villain, John Drew, and his sometimes unwitting accomplices. Chief among those was the struggling artist John Myatt, a vulnerable single father who was manipulated by Drew into becoming a prolific art forger. Drew managed to infiltrate the archives of the upper echelons of the British art world to fake the provenance of Myatt's forged pieces. The story stretches from London to Paris to New York, from Tony Manhattan art galleries to the archives at the Tate Gallery. This enormous swindle resulted in the introduction of at least 200 forged paintings, some of them breathtakingly good, and most of them selling for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Many of these fakes are still out in prestigious galleries and private collections, considered to be genuine. Provenance reads like a well-plotted thriller filled with unforgettable characters. Marty Peterson narrates this meticulously researched and captivating account of one of the greatest cons in the history of art forgery.
An economist as well as an art historian, Sirota was not shy about forming ties with corporations, wealthy new patrons, and private collectors. To float a single Cézanne exhibition, his accountants scheduled more than 40 champagne receptions. Later, Sirota would inaugurate the Unilever series, the Tate's first brand marketing collaboration with a company, and museum patrons visiting the restrooms would find the cubicles adorned with a discreet notice, similar to those underneath some of its most famous paintings, thanking an anonymous benefactor for donating the wherewithal to keep them in toilet rolls, as The Guardian reported. The director did not have much choice. The art market was booming, and the Tate and many other art institutions were being priced out of the business. To keep the museum's goals and galleries afloat, its directors and trustees were forced to tango with any number of prospective donors. John Drew was the perfect dance partner. He had been cultivating his relationship with the Tate for weeks, organizing lunches at the restaurant at Claridge's Hotel for curators and senior staffers, including Fox Pitt. If Sirota embodied a new, less class-conscious Briton, he was known to wash his staff's teacups after meetings, Fox Pitt was old world. A slim and sophisticated aristocrat in her late 40s, she had worked at the Tate as a curator and archivist for more than a decade and had carved out her own fiefdom. Her archives had become an important part of the museum, and she was always looking for ways to expand. She had a reputation as a fearsome gatekeeper with X-ray vision that allowed her to peer into the heart of anyone she suspected of harboring anything less than the most altruistic motives toward the Tate. One luckless acquaintance who failed to pass muster recalled how Fox Pitt looked through him, then past him, as if she had determined with a single glance that he was useless for her purposes. Drew had piqued her interest from the start. He was versed in the archival arts and spoke eloquently about a cache of important letters, catalogs, and lecture notes that had passed through his hands over the years. He seemed to know a great deal about 20th century art records, particularly those of the Avant-Garde Institute of Contemporary Arts and the British Council. And he boasted about his own private archive, which he said contained letters from Picasso, lecture notes from Ben Nicholson, and a trove of material from Dubuffet and other major artists. In the course of his conversations with Fox Pitt, Drew talked at length about his background in the sciences. He had an impressive lineage. His father, a noted British physicist, had worked on the development of Britain's atomic energy program and had split the atom in Cambridge in the early 1930s. Drew had followed in his father's footsteps by going to work in the nuclear industry. In midlife, he had become fascinated with art and its history, and as his collection grew, he began to understand the importance of archives and documentation. He had developed a collector's gratitude for the role played by archivists in the safeguarding of art history, and he hinted to Fox Pitt that parts of his collection, as well as some other valuable historical documents, might find their proper home at the Tate. He also hinted that he was considering a substantial monetary donation to the archives. To the general public, museums are synonymous with the art that hangs on the walls. Few are aware that these institutions also take on the monumental task of assembling a record of an uninterrupted chain of ownership for each important work of art, from the moment of its creation to the sale of the work to its most recent owner. Exhibition catalogs help document the custodial history of the work, and receipts of sale show where and when it passed through private hands. Diaries, correspondence, and early drawings also shed light on the works themselves. Today, it is this documentary record of ownership, as much as any professional evaluation of quality or artistic style, that confirms the authenticity of a work of art. In the world of art, the process is known as establishing provenance. In the early 20th century, museums began setting up archives to store these records. It was and remains the role of the archivist to make sure that files are updated and, most importantly, that they are never corrupted. Access to museum archives is closely monitored, with entree restricted to those having a legitimate need. Despite the heavy burden archives bear in protecting the integrity of works of art, archivists are the beggars of the art world. It is far easier to persuade patrons to donate works from their private collections for display on the museum walls, or to write a check to fund the purchase of a new work, or build a museum wing, than it is to convince them to fund the expansion or refinement of an archivist's database.
We've just heard Provenance by Lainey Salisbury and Ali Sujo. My guest today, Peter Silverman, is a noted art collector and the author of a fascinating new book, Leonardo's Lost Princess. The story begins in New York in 1998 at Christie's annual Old Masters sale. One of the items is most unusual, a 9x13-inch profile of a glorious young woman drawn in chalk, pen, and ink on vellum, glued to an oak panel. Christie's listed the work as an early 19th century German, but Silverman believed the venerable auction house had made an enormous mistake. In his book, written with Catherine Whitney, Silverman recounts his journey to bring the picture into the art world spotlight. When he bought the drawing in 2007 for $19,000, many scoffed at his purchase. But Silverman persevered, consulting with top Leonardo experts who used carbon dating and high-tech cameras that probed beneath the surface of the work, in effect, peeling it away layer by layer. And so, La Bella Principessa, da Vinci's portrait of Bianca, an illegitimate daughter of a Milanese duke, is now appraised at $150 million. Welcome, Peter. Thanks so much for joining us at the Book Report.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
What first attracted you to the piece?
I saw it at Christie's in a catalog. I was still in Paris. I noticed that it was cataloged as German 19th century. I was a bit intrigued by that. But as far as I was concerned, it looked like it was 15th century, and it was a beautiful portrait of a beautiful young woman.
Absolutely.
And it looked like it was from the Renaissance to me.
So when did you begin to think that it might have been a da Vinci?
Well, that wasn't right away. That was, you know, it was so unlikely that a Leonardo da Vinci would be floating around. You know, I'm a naturally skeptical person. We're collecting for 30 years, and we know so many stories about people get carried away with big names. But as soon as we saw it, we did believe it was from the 15th century, and I immediately thought it was by an artist in the circle of Botticelli or Ghirlandaio. And we started started studying it, and over a year's time, I bought all the books there were on Ghirlandaio, Leonardo da Vinci's workshop, the students who could have, you know, possibly been influenced by him, and I could not find, for the life of me, by whom it could be. And then, quite fortuitously, I was in the Louvre with my digital camera looking at a painting by Boltraffio, who is Leonardo's best student, trying to figure out, could this possibly be the same hand as did this portrait? And just at that moment, walks by Nicholas Turner, one of the top experts in the world, formerly with the Getty and the British Museum, and he says to me, I say, "Hi, Nicholas, amazing to meet you here. I'm just looking at this painting by one of Leonardo's top pupils, and I happen to have a painting by, which I was trying to attribute, and it just doesn't seem to work out. Maybe you have an idea who it's by." So I show him the photo in my digital camera. He looks at it and says, "Wow, that's extraordinary, Peter. I think I have an idea who it's by." And I said, "Oh, really?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Well, is it by this fellow, Boltraffio?" He said, no, I think it's even better." I said, "Who could that possibly be by then?" He said, "Well, I personally think it could very well be by Leonardo da Vinci."
In your book, you talk about authenticating the work and the way you had to do it on three fronts: artistic, historical, and scientific. Can you share a little bit about the process?
Well, the first thing that one has to be excited about is, you know, the quality of a work. The first criteria one should ask oneself is, does this correspond to something is it beautiful? And, well, it did have that hallmark. We found it beautiful. Is it from the period? We did believe it was from the period. So the next step was to get somebody like Martin Kemp, who spent the last 40 years studying Leonardo, to give his opinion. He's a naturally skeptical person. He gets offered Leonardos almost every day, so-called Leonardos. And so we sent him the photo, and he said, "Well, this is a little more serious, to be taken a little more seriously than any of the other things I've seen in the last years. Why don't you submit it to the laboratory in Paris, which is doing revolutionary work, which has a multi-spectral digital camera, unique in the world, Lumiere technology, and see what they say, because their camera can analyze the work scientifically, but without taking any of the material off the painting, without touching the painting." So we brought it to Lumiere Technology. John Pennicot and Pascal Cut of Lumiere Technology are sitting there with the work in their hand, and they were sort of pale. I said, "Mr. Silverman, do you realize what you have here?" And I said, "Yes, it's a 19th century German drawing." And they said, "Well, you know, we have a database on this artist. We've already analyzed two of his paintings, and it seems to come up to be the same artist, comparing the databases." And I said, "Oh, really? And who do you think it's by?" I said, "Well, we think it's by Leonardo da Vinci." I said, "Oh, really?" I was still playing dumb. I said, "Yes, we've compared it to the Mona Lisa and the Lady with the Ermine, which we've digitalized, and we think it's by da Vinci. Didn't you have a suspicion?" And I said, "Of course I did. I just wanted you guys to figure it out first."
Uh-huh. Well, revelation for me in the book was that da Vinci was left-handed, and this fact actually helped in authenticating the portrait. Isn't that right?
Well, it's a whole gamut of things put together which points to the fact that it can only be by Leonardo da Vinci. The first thing that someone pointed out, one of the top art historians in the world, Mina Gregori, she said that when she first saw it, she said to us, "Well, let's analyze this carefully. The face of the sitter is very, very Florentine in its conception, and that's somebody who obviously was influenced or worked in the circle of Ghirlandaio or Botticelli. But then again, you've got the hairdo and the costume, which are typical of Milano and the court of Milan in 1490-95. And then you have here these lines which show that it's by a left-handed artist. And by process of deduction, I mean, this is the simplest of arguments, which is so valid, she said to me, "You've got a left-handed artist He's Florentine of origin. He's working at the court of Milan. I don't know anybody else capable of doing this except Leonardo da Vinci, because he was there during that time. And that's how we got to the attribution of Leonardo da Vinci by another top art historian.
Well, all right. Amazing. Now, the subject is Bianca Sforza. So tell us a little about her history.
She was a young woman who was the illegitimate daughter of the head of the leading ruler of Milan. And he decided to marry her off to his chief general, who Sansovino, at 13 years of age, because, you know, these dynasties, to continue dynasties, you marry off your daughters to people who can be of help to you and of service to you. So she was married off to Galeazzo Sansovino at the age of 13. And tragically, she died 4 months later of probably a pregnancy gone wrong.
So the drawing may have been a frontispiece for a book. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Well, just by chance, Martin Kemp received a letter from a wonderful Renaissance art historian from South Florida University called David Wright, who said, Martin, there happens to be a book in Warsaw called La Sforziada in the National Library of Warsaw, which was printed on vellum and which was printed in honor of Galeazzo Sansovino. And the marriage, and there is a miniature in this by a man called Birago, who is a top miniaturist of the period, which depicts various things concerning the marriage of Sansovino to Bianca Sforza. Why don't you check out in Warsaw whether this page could have perhaps been extracted from this book? And that was done last year, and amazingly enough, a facsimile was brought, and everything matched the size, the fact that it was also on vellum, and the fact that the drawing has pinholes in it for binding. And we have found 3.5 pinholes, because some of it was cut when it was cut out of this book. There would have been 5 pinholes, which shows that this drawing was once in this volume dedicated to the marriage of Galeazzo and Bianca Sforza. It's an amazing story.
This is some really top-notch investigation. So actually, what is the current value of the Bella Principessa?
Well, this was established by a former director of Christie's, Simon Dickinson. He estimated that it had a value of about $150 million.
Well, readers, I want to let you know that this book reads like an adventure mystery. It's accurate art history, absolutely, but it's so readable. You are just going to be amazed by this story. Peter, I loved reading your book. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate your having me on your program, and I look forward to being on it again Monday when I write another book.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Next on the book report, we're going to hear a sampling of Luncheon of the Boating Party by Susan Freeland. The book tells the tale of Auguste Renoir's masterpiece. The painting depicts a gathering of Renoir's real friends enjoying a summer Sunday along the Seine. A wealthy painter, an art collector, an Italian journalist, a war hero, a celebrated actress, and Renoir's future wife, among others, share this moment of La Vie Moderne, a time when social constraints were loosening and Paris was healing after the Franco-Prussian War. Parisians were bursting with a desire for pleasure and a yearning to create something extraordinary out of their lives. Renoir shared these urges and took on this most challenging project at a time of personal crises in art and love, all the while facing issues of loyalty and the diverging styles that were tearing the Impressionists apart. The story illuminates the gusto, hedonism, and art of this era. With a gorgeous palette of vibrant, captivating characters, Karen White narrates this portrait of a much-loved time in art history.
They had slapped each other on the back the day they'd discovered that juxtaposed patches of contrasting color could show the movement of sunlit water. What he would give for another day like that one, for that thrill of breaking new ground. Repeating safe, easy methods, portrait after portrait, as he'd been doing lately, was suffocating him. In the distance, a catboat sailing toward him looked like the Iris, one of Gustave's boats. He rowed toward it. Yes, it was. He stood up to his full height on the foot platforms, twisted to hail him with his left arm, and lost his balance. The front wheel jerked sideways, and the cycle tipped and crashed onto its side. His right hip and shoulder struck sand and gravel, his hand and elbow in the cast taking the fall, his face taking the bounce. The broken smokestack landed on his left leg. His right leg was trapped under one rear wheel, while the other rear wheel spun with a tick, tick, tick. Boiling water splashed and oil leaked onto his pant leg. He struggled to disentangle himself before getting burned. Jesus Christ! He would destroy himself if he didn't start painting soon. He spit out sand and lay trembling in a cloud of steam, trying to figure out what had happened and watching the glints of light riding the water. How different the colors from this low angle, the contrast between tips of ripples and valleys between them more pronounced now, a deeper forest green for the furrows, with shifting patches of yellow-green and ochre on the humps, and the silver highlights more transparent than he'd ever seen them. My God, to show that to the world. A throbbing moved up through his legs, hip, shoulder. His right cheek and hand stung. Sand had scoured his palm and left it bloody. He staggered to his feet. Bazile's dear old color box had suffered too. The corners splintered, one hinge sprung, the other twisted. Tubes and brushes lay scattered in the tall grasses, the canvas face down in a muddy patch. The Iris, with Gustave oblivious at the helm, was only a triangle of white sail downriver. Using his left arm and all his weight, he tried to pull the cycle upright, but it refused to budge. The monster weighed more than he did. The front wheel was bent. He could never steer it now. He turned off the oil burner and opened the steam release valve. The hissing quieted to a gurgle. Below the trademark, Peugeot, he saw the model name. La vie moderne. Modern life. He chortled. That was the subject matter of the new painting movement, as precarious as the steam cycle. He crouched at the river's edge and cupped some water in his left hand to rinse his mouth. A pain shot up his thigh. He splashed his right hand to loosen the grit embedded in his palm. The cool water stung. He crawled through the weeds to gather his brushes and tubes, but couldn't find yellow ochre. If he were well off, or at least stable, he could do without it because he could make it from other colors. But those tubes were almost squeezed flat already. A muttering duck glided between reeds toward a tube of paint. He quacked at it in a tone that said, "Leave it alone." The duck paddled away. The scent of wild roses assailed him. Any other time, the sight of them would have excited him, their petal faces pale pink and cream like women's cheeks, like Jeanne's. At least he'd found his beloved bicycle cap. Now all he needed was to find his way. In painting, in love, in life. He carried brushes in his right hand and the color box of his dead friend in his left, the lid dangling. He set off limping the 10-minute walk along the wooded strip to the Ile du Chatou. Just north of the railroad bridge, he would come to Maison Fournaise, the boater's guinguette, the riverside restaurant, hotel, and boat rental frequented by painters and writers, where he had thought to try out an idea on the little canvas.
We've just heard Luncheon of the Boating Party by Susan Vreeland. Some of the 20th century's most important artists and writers, from Jackson Pollock to Saul Steinberg, have lived and worked on the East End of Long Island. Critic and poet Robert Long writes about the group in De Kooning's Bicycle, Artists and Writers in the Hamptons. The book traces how living in the area affected this stellar group and impacted their creative work for years to come. Pollock found a connection to nature there that inspired some of the most significant painting of our time. Willem de Kooning rode his bike every day to Gardner's Bay, where its light seemed to shine through every brushstroke he put to canvas from the early 1960s on. Through searching lyrical vignettes, Long mixes storytelling with history to recreate these lives and events that shaped American art and literature. Grover Gardner narrates.
The settlers realized that whales were valuable in manifold ways. Their oil was the most efficient fuel for illumination available, and everything from buggy whips and candles to corsets and collar stays could be fashioned from their bones and baleen. The economies of Southampton and Easthampton thereby flourished in a way no one had anticipated. The disposal of whales was at first a communal effort. Because time was of the essence, whales rot quickly, everyone was expected to lend a hand in the unpleasant business of hacking up the smelly carcasses and cooking down the blubber. Children were even let out of school. Anyone who did not participate could be fined. The Eastenders made the process as efficient as they could. Whaleboats patrolled the coast for weeks at a time. On shore, a paid whale watcher alerted the town when he spotted a glossy black back breaking the ocean's skin. A crew of six, four rowers, a tiller, and a harpooner, piled into a 20-foot cedar whaleboat, patterned after the Indian's dugout canoe. They chased down the creature, hoping to puncture its heart or lung. If the wound was made accurately, the whale could be towed to shore. If not, the whale dragged the men behind it for hours until it tired, all the while snapping the boat in its wake like the tail of a kite. By the mid-1660s, whaling had evolved into the private enterprise of a few fortunate families. It took capital to purchase a whaleboat, harpoons, the expensive iron kettle used to boil blubber, and special barrels for whale oil, and it was an investment most families could not afford to make. The Montaukett Indians, whose bartering arrangements with the settlers left them permanently in debt, entered into contracts in which they agreed to work for the whaling companies to settle those debts. In this way, they were bound to the English from year to year with little hope of paying all that they owed. The early whaling companies paid their employees with small amounts of cash and with whale bounty. The Indians were given fins, and the English received 3-foot hunks of meat. The industry thus hastened the stratification of white society on the East End. And in a community that numbered about 500, resentments flourished and were often played out in court, for the settlers and their early descendants were a litigious lot. Complaints were routinely filed over trivial matters, the most popular being slander and defamation of character. By 1700, Amagansett had become the main source for whale oil and whalebone on the eastern seaboard. A thriving market economy was now in place on the East End. Social classes had been established. It was almost impossible to buy land unless you were descended from one of the settling families or extremely wealthy. And then the whales simply stopped coming. It would be years before the hunt for them resumed, this time in 3-masted ships out of Sag Harbor. In the meantime, the East End lost its position on the front line of the economy, a victim of what later centuries would call overfishing. There was little reason for Eastenders to maintain more than a tenuous connection with the rest of the world, and they reverted to obscurity. The families who had managed to get in on the whaling boom retained an aura of importance. They owned the most valuable land in the hearts of the villages and along the ocean. Those who hadn't claimed a stake constituted the servant class and lived in outlying areas. The Long Island Railroad tracks would come to mark the dividing line between the classes, then the Montauk Highway, when it became the more popular travel route. South of the highway still means class on the East End. As late as 1878, a visitor would describe East Hampton thus. It is 5 miles from Sag Harbor, 15 from Greenport, and about 100 miles from New York. But from the way they are behind the times, should think they were about 5,000. Sag Harbor, however, had vitality. It was one of the most important whaling ports on the East Coast from the time of the Revolutionary War until 1857, when a financial crash killed off the industry for the second time. In any case, the discovery of petroleum a few years earlier meant that whale oil and spermaceti would soon be replaced by kerosene and paraffin. The most notable cultural presence on the East End until the end of the 19th century was that of a woodworking family, the Dominies. They were East Hampton farmers who in the off-seasons made about 1,000 pieces of furniture over 65 years, handing down the craft through several generations. Nathaniel Dominey IV and his son and grandson ignored changing fashions and technological advances, but each added a specialty to the family's arsenal, and they had a wide range of clients among the wealthier citizens of the East End. By the mid-19th century, the demand for their custom-made chairs, tables, desks, and bureaus had fallen as large companies began providing cheap, well-made furniture. But the Domineys had something else to offer, though it didn't fatten their purses. When hordes of painters descended upon East Hampton in the 1880s, the Dominey farmhouse, sagging with age, and its adjoining workshop became a popular subject. Nathaniel Dominey VII sometimes stepped outside to watch the artists work at their easels. "You fellows get $1,000 in York for a picture of my back door," he'd say, "and I get nothing." Lange Island, as the Dutch labeled it on maps, is sediment left by a glacier that plowed south as it melted for thousands of years, part of its detritus the South Fork, a hilly scrubby ridge that slopes off to bays on the north, the ocean on the south. Like bubbles in pancake batter, pockets formed in the glacial sediment, kettle holes that held meltwater in the form of bays, ponds, harbors, and creeks. Because the Dutch wanted eastern Long Island, Lion Gardner was sent there in the early 1630s to keep them from having it. He did so by building and commanding a fort at the mouth of the Connecticut River, north of Long Island. The fort also was meant to subdue the Pequot Indians, who had their own plans for the East End. In 1637, the nation was all but wiped out when Gardner's men set fire to the Indian fort. Those who fled the inferno were shot or hacked up with swords. The Montaukett Indians, who had been paying protection money to the Pequots, began paying off the English instead. In a deal struck with Gardner by Wyandance, the Montaukett chief, the English were granted exclusive trading rights with the tribe. With a continuous source of wampum, Gardner could trade shells for whatever his heart desired, including beaver skins, which London merchants coveted. In this manner, he acquired Gardner's Island, which he named the Isle of Wight on taking ownership of it in 1639. About a decade later, the English governors of the Connecticut and New Haven colonies bought what is now East Hampton Town for a pile of looking glasses, hatchets and knives, 20 coats and 100 muxes, the small metal drills used to string wampum on leather strips. 2 years later, they resold East Hampton to Gardner for $30,000. At about the same time, the English acquired Southampton from the Shinnecocks in return for protecting them from the Narragansetts, and promptly segregated the Indians in Shinnecock Hills, where the golf club bearing their name and designed by Stanford White would be erected 250 years later.
We've just heard De Kooning's Bicycle by Robert Long.
Separates a masterpiece from a piece of junk. Thanks to Antiques Roadshow, everyone is searching garage sales and hunting online for hidden gems, wondering whether their attics contain trash or treasures. In The Art Detective, Fakes, Frauds, and Finds, and The Search for Lost Treasures, Philip Mould, an authority on British portraiture and an irreverent and delightful expert for The Roadshow, serves up his secrets and his best stories, blending the technical details of art detection and restoration with juicy tales peopled by eccentric collectors, scholars, and forgers. Each chapter focuses on one particular painting and the mystery that surrounds it. Mould is a trusty detective, tracking down clues, uncovering human foibles, and following hunches until the truth is revealed. Mould is known for his ability to crack the toughest puzzles, and whether he's writing about a fake Norman Rockwell, a hidden Rembrandt, or a lost Gainsborough, he brings both the art and the adventure to life. James Langton narrates.
First, a restorer told me that he had been sent down to analyze the painting's condition a week before the sale. Then a dealer confided that in partnership with another, he had been prepared to go up to £500,000. And later, I met another who had prepared a bid for twice that amount, but did not get his hand up at the sale because the price escalated so fast. The following month, I talked with a major London auctioneer who told me that he had been tipped off by one of his clients and had taken the day off to travel down by train to view it. If you add the man who underbid, the distinguished New York dealer Otto Naumann, I later discovered, the successful purchasers who apparently bought on behalf of a private collector, and the runners, dealers without galleries who seize opportunities at country sales, who had been aware of it, I can see now that I was naively out of the loop. This realization, in part, prompted me to write the present book. One of the most obvious ways to explain how so many people in different countries were aware of a diminutive painting in a relatively small auction house 2.5 hours from London is the technological revolution. The internet is now an integral tool in the workings of my business. It is amusingly ironic that I, a dealer with a certain knowledge, failed to see something when physically present in an auction room, while a shoal of prospective buyers, a large proportion of the informed old master trade, had been frantically researching and preparing bids for some weeks before the sale, after the illustrated catalogue was posted on the auction house website. Sure, many would have come down to see it as a consequence of what they had seen online, but only as a consequence. And I knew, of course, that it would not just have been the fact that there was a high-quality digital image of the picture for all to find with their search engines, but that with a few clicks of the mouse, it could instantly be shared with others, curators, art historians, fellow dealers, prospective clients, all of whom could offer responses, no doubt some of them guarded, which would translate into the type of bidding fervour that was witnessed that day in Cirencester. This is the culture we now occupy, a market that has 1,000 eyes on anything and everything of possible significance that raises its head over the commercial parapet. And it is not just the raw commodity that is so much more accessible, but knowledge too. The ability to research and compare prospective discoveries has developed at the same expansive rate. For the skilled researcher has within immediate reach myriad public collections, archives, articles, price records, and biographies that can either shore up or kill a hunch with lightning speed. For a discovery to be established, discoveries that it has to work on paper as well as in paint. Crucial aspects of a picture's provenance, its history, can sometimes be instantly established, discoveries that 15 or 20 years ago might have taken days, if not weeks, of professional archival research. In a business fraught with auction deadlines, the internet's power makes the dealing of the previous generation look like dark prehistory. Yet it is not just information technology that has progressed, but also technical analysis, the means by which the physical properties of a painting can be diagnosed and understood. Scientists in lab coats are now increasingly entering the formerly forbidden world of artistic attribution. To me, one of the most valuable functions of science is to be able to establish a picture's terminus postquern, the earliest likely date that it was painted. Databases and other scientific tools still have far to travel in this area, but paint analysis has become more precise in establishing the physical compounds of pigments and the way in which they are applied and, when combined with the use of ever-growing records of when these pigments were first found to have been used and by whom, can add valuable corroborative evidence. Scientific data is one of the bedrocks of the Rembrandt Research Project, the authentication panel chaired by Professor van der Wettering, which I describe in a later chapter. The RRP has helped create convincing arguments that have turned formerly overlooked copies into multi-million pound originals, and also, sometimes very painfully for the owners, the reverse. Scientific analysis for the picture hunter has also become much easier to commission. When I first joined the art business in the mid-1980s, even organizing an X-ray to ascertain whether an earlier image might be lurking beneath a painting's surface was a palaver. It meant queuing up on a Monday morning at certain private London hospitals, while the less fortunate with damaged limbs waited for the same service.
That was The Art Detective by Philip Mould.
Readers, I hope you've enjoyed this stroll through the art world's brilliant literary landscape. Remember to check my website, bookreportradio.com, for a colorful collection of the summer's top titles. Thanks so much for joining me today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.